This is episode 11 of season 4, so that is episode 411 of The Bad Apples. In this episode, I'm going to be giving you the 411, see how I tied that in nicely, on Unix groups and how to use them. I'm going to be talking about drivers and sort of some of the things that we go through when installing them, and kind of how to install them and how to find them and stuff like that. And then I'll take some listener feedback, so stay tuned. We've been dying to contribute to KDE lately, and you don't code, and you don't do designing, and you don't do documentation, and you just don't have time for anything, and you have no talent whatsoever. Well, one thing you can do, no matter what else you can't do, one thing you can do is take a quick online survey. And no, this isn't one of those surveys like that you take on Facebook or that, you know, asks you for your mailing address and your phone number and your email address and your name and your mother's maiden name and your mother's social security number and your dog's name and your children's ages, you know, and all that other good stuff. This is an actual survey, and it doesn't care who you are or what you are. It actually wants you no matter what. It just wants input from the community. And by community, I do mean a really broad cross-section. So if you've got a friend who doesn't use Linux at all, maybe, who hates computers, possibly, try to get them to take the survey, because these are the people we want, they want to take the survey. And this is a usability survey, and you can find it at www.oxygen-icons.org/survey. That is oxygen-icons.org/survey. And what this does is it's going to be presenting you, the public, with a different application that they're working on. You know, right now it's sort of the ones, it seems to be the ones that they're porting over to KDE 4, the very, very popular, very, very effective, very, very good CD and DVD burning and ripping and everything else application, so K3B. And what they needed to do was figure out which icons might be, you know, might represent certain concepts. And this is important because this is what GUI programs are all about, right? I mean, the reason there's a graphic user interface is because they want people to be able to look at an interface and look around and kind of discover what they want to do with that program. If they didn't want that, they wouldn't make a GUI front end to said application. And you would simply have to type in man K3B or, you know, K4B or whatever we're going to call our imaginary no front-end application. And it would give you all the switches that you could use, and you could put together your command just how you like it, and you can echo it into some kind of archive file so that you'll never forget that again, and voila, there you go. But they want you to have a GUI application. They want people to be able to click around and click on pretty icons and do what they want to do. So in order for these icons to make sense to the everyday user, they want as many everyday users and pro users and power users and everyone else to take this survey. So you should do it. oxygen-icons.org/survey. Right now, at least last time I checked, which I check about every week, it's K3B and KDevelop. Okay, this was an interesting spectrum to me, because as a multimedia sort of guy, K3B was, I mean, that's part of my bread and butter. It's something about media. It's, you know, getting media off of media and getting content off of media and back onto other media, etc. So this was a, you know, looking at those icons, I felt, yeah, this is easy. This is exactly what it should be. And then I took the one for KDevelop, and I was just, I mean, you know me. I mean, I'm trying to become a programmer at some point, but I mean, they were asking questions that I just had no idea. You know, I was just, how about that button? You know, so it was really good, because that way they got a quote-unquote professional view on the K3B icons and a complete utter noob opinion on the KDevelop icons. I don't know if either of them helped, but at least I took the survey. And I got a couple of friends to take the survey, less computer-savvy friends, so they got some feedback there. So, you know, just take the icon survey. Check back every week or every other week, and they should be posting more. So do that. It will help. And it will help usability, and it will help KDE. And both of those things are good. If you've been using Linux for a while, you probably kind of are familiar to some degree with the concept of a Unix user. And the user would be, in any given situation, you, or the person logged in. That's the Unix user, someone who is logged into a system. And as a user, you've got a certain number of, you own files, first of all, and then you have a certain number of permissions to do something with that file. You can sometimes read it, you can sometimes write it, and sometimes execute that file, if it's an executable file, like a shell script or an application. The way that you get this ownership and get these permissions is typically if you create a file, that would be one way you own it. Or if you've copied it off of an external drive or something, especially like if you're just coming from a Windows machine or a Mac, and you're doing this with a FAT 32 volume or something like that, which doesn't have ownership, then if you're copying that off of the drive onto your computer, you're going to inherit, you get ownership of that file. And by default, you get read, write, and again, if applicable, execute permissions for that file. Now, you can give ownership of a file to someone. So if I needed to give a file over to Gort, I can do a chown, chown, change ownership, Gort, foobar.txt, where Gort is the username of the person I'm giving the file to. I can also change permissions of that. So if this could get hairy, so I'm just going to do the easy way. Chmod, chmod, u plus rwx, foobar.txt. That would give the user read, write, and execute permission. You could also give a group read and write and execute, or others read and write and execute. And what does all that mean? Well, that's what we're going to get into right now. Again, this whole user setup seems to work fairly well, at least for, 40 years now Unix has been around. So if you're just the typical everyday Linux user coming from Microsoft or Apple, and you're thinking, well, so what is all this user and group stuff? Because all I know is that I'm a user, and everything seems to either work or not work sometimes, and that's that. Because, I mean, even though Unix is a multi-user system, if you're just one user on your machine, and that's all whoever logs into the machine, then, yeah, you're kind of oblivious to the whole concept of users and groups and others. And it's kind of almost easier to understand if you've got a big multi-user system set up, because that's when this really starts to work for you. So let's say, for instance, that I've got me and Gort are hanging out, and we've got a system that we both have access to. Maybe it's a server where we're keeping all of our files, or maybe it's a computer we're sharing, or a computer that he's SSHing into, or whatever. But we're on the same, I guess it would be the same physical computer, or the same, I guess it would be the same physical computer. So we're on the same system. And he's a user, his username is Gort, I'm a user, my username is Klaatu. Now, if I want to start collaborating with Gort on a certain file, meaning that I want us to both be able to open up this file, read it, write it, and even execute it if it's a program, how can I get that done? Well, for this is where the group thing comes into play. And now, groups, especially in the, I guess, let's just say, like, less hands-on distros, Fedora included, a lot of times the group thing is really blurred with user, because when you make a user, it says, hey, I'll just make you a group, and the group name will be the same as your username. So the user and group are practically the same. If you look at if you go to a terminal and you go to your home partition, your home folder, and you do an ls-l, then you get everything in a list form, and you'll see everything that is in your home folder, and you'll see who owns it, and you'll see who what permissions they have. So in the far left, you'll see, for instance, in this particular home directory that I'm on right now, there's nothing in there except a whole bunch of directories. So I see D for directory, and then rwx, r-x, r-x, meaning, and this is a typical default file permission for a home folder, means that that's a directory, and then it means that the user has read, write, and execute, the group has read and execute, and the others have read and execute. And again, that would be in math, 755, because the R's, you assign those the value of 4, the W, 2, and the X, a value of 1. And so if you add them up in groups of 3, that's what you get. RWX is 7, R-X would be 5, R-X would be 5. Meaning that anyone in the group that I'm in gets to read and execute anything in my home directory. They don't get to write to it. They just get to look at it and possibly execute it if it's an executable file. and same with others. Others can read and execute. Now, I could change that if I wanted to with a chmod dash r, you know, whatever, or I could leave it as is. So in this particular case, the user and the group are the same. So I see in the what is this, third and fourth column of an ls space dash l, clat2 and clat2, meaning that the user is clat2 and his group is clat2. Now this is on a Fedora system. If I SSH over into my Slackware box, I see something a little bit different. I see that the user is clat2 and the group is users. Okay, because Slackware doesn't create a specific group just for you. It makes a group called users, which is kind of nice. Now, for this to all make sense, let's do it kind of on a project basis. So if we're, let's say not only, in fact, not only Gort and I are collaborating, let's say all the Linux cranks are collaborating on a file. Maybe this is some big project we're doing. We're all logged into the same server. We have lots of files that we're sharing back and forth. So what we would do in this case is we would establish a new group to indicate a collection of users who we want to be able to see certain files, see and use certain files. This would be, let's say, we would do a group add. We would become root, and then you issue the command group add, groupadd, and we'll call the group cranks, group add cranks. And then we can add some users to that group, and the way to do that as root, you just vim or you know, text edit somehow, Pico, Nano, whatever you use, Emacs, /etc/group, and that's singular group. And in this file, you will see lots and lots of entries. And a lot of these groups are kind of like the systems groups. You don't get to really mess around with them that much. There might be a Jack group. There might be a MySQL group. But you will eventually start seeing things like clat2:x:500. That would be meaning that's his little special group. You might see monsterb:x:501. That would be his little group. And so on and so forth. Peter64, 502, Cranks, 503. So the Cranks is the group that we just added, and this would be the one that we want to add users to. And to add users to that, it's quite simple. You simply type in the names of the users after the final colon. So if we've got a Cranks:x:whatever:, then we want to type in clat2:monsterb:peter64:330:azimuth:evilazimuth, all the different users that we have on the system that we want in the group Cranks. And let's not add Gort, actually. Maybe we've gotten angry at Gort, and we don't want to add him to this group. So we'll leave him out so that we can see what kind of permission he has at the end of all this. So now all we have to do is change foobar.txt so that the group is Cranks, and then we need to make sure that the group Cranks has, or the group assigned to that file has, for instance, read and write permission. So to do that, we would just do a chown, chown, clat2:cranks, okay? So on the left side of that colon is clat2, that's the username. So the user, clat2, actually owns that file because I created it. And then :cranks, that's the group that owns the file because that's the group that I, as the user, I want to give everyone in the group Cranks permission to do something to foobar.txt. And the next command I'll give will, and I can verify that again, you know, ls space dash l, that'll show me that yes, now the third and fourth column will be clat2 and Cranks, respectively. And then to give permission to that group to do something, it would just be a chmod, chmod space g for group, and then I'm going to add, so plus read and write permissions, rw, space foobar.txt. So that's chmod g plus rw foobar.txt. And then I could confirm that with ls-l, and I would see that in the first triplet I've got the user rwx, and then the second triplet would be the group, so that would be rw dash, and then probably in other, realistically, it would be r-x, possibly, let's say. Well, maybe I don't want the others to have any permission at all, because others might constitute Gort, right? Well, I don't want Gort to see what we're doing. So I'll do a chmod O for others minus RWX. I'm taking all permission away from others. Foobar.txt. Okay? So now others have no permission. Group has R and W. And then clat2 has everything. So now what we would just to test this, and you can certainly test this on your own, and this isn't going to work, just to warn you, but it's for a good reason. So to test this on the system, we would su switch user dash Peter64. That's su space dash space Peter64, so that we're inheriting his user space. That's what the dash does. And then the password, and then we can do a less space /home/clat2/foobar.txt. And shockingly, we get permission denied. Why would that happen? Because we just thought we just did all those commands to get the permission to, you know, get the group cranks set up, and we gave permission to the cranks to see the file, and yet now we're logged in as Peter64 in his user space, trying to do a less on a file, and it's not working. Well, the reason, of course, is because, yeah, Peter64 is in the cranks group, and the cranks group certainly does have permission to read and write foobar.txt. But the one thing that I used to always forget about and would cause me endless frustration is that foobar.txt is located in /home/clat2. And Peter64 and or the cranks do not have permission to read into clat2's home directory. The only person right now with permission to read into clat2's home directory, and this makes sense. I mean, if you've got, let's say I've got free coffee to hand out to people, but only people with a key into my house would be able to come in and get the free coffee. So I've made the coffee free, but I've accidentally locked them out of the house. Same idea. So the answer would be either to drastically change my home directory permissions, which I'm not going to do, or to simply place foobar.txt in a common area where all the users do have access to it. So I might go so far as to, for instance, make a new user called Cranks and use his group, you know, Cranks, so that everyone has kind of, that could be the shared space for this Cranks project that I'm working on. Or I might simply make a folder out in the home folder, you know, and call it Cranks and give it and make sure that the Cranks group has permission to it and others have no permission to it. And then they can put all the shared files in there, and then that would kind of solve that as well. So, and that's basically how groups work. So again, sort of a quick overview. To add a group, it's group add, and then the name of the group. And then to add names, to add users to that group, you simply go in and edit /etc/group, and add the usernames to the group that you want them to be a group member of. And then you simply make sure that the files that you need them to access are in some common area where they can all really access them, and that the permissions for all the files and that directory are choned to username colon group name. Simple as that. Now, what about this whole other concept? Well, there's Gort hanging around out there, right? And he's not in the Cranks group, and he's not in the clat2 group. He's Gort, and he has maybe a group of Gort. So he's kind of an isolated, sort of off on his own user. So Gort is other. He is not a user. He's not the group. He's not a member of the group. He is other. So if we make a directory out in /home, for instance, say we create a directory called /home/cranks. And we give that cranks directory read write execute --. That means that Gort is not going to be able to get into that folder at all. He can't look in it. He can't write out to it. He can't execute anything within it. If we add rwx rwx r --, then Gort can actually get into that folder to read files, as long as they also have the other permissions set to read. So we might have a directory that lets him in, but we might be hiding everything inside the directory from other. Or we might go ahead and let him look. Maybe we want his comments now. So we're going to add, we're going to do a chmod, well, we could really just do a chmod-r, capital R, O plus R, right? So that would be recursively chmod, so everything in, you know, /home/cranks, so that quote-unquote other has read permissions. And that would ripple through the entire directory and make sure that everything gets the R flag added to the O column. Then Gort could come in, look around, read everything he wants to read. He could never write to that folder, and he could not execute anything within it, but he could at least look around. We could also give him write permissions the same way, chmod-r O plus W, and then it's going to ripple through and do everything so that others have writing permission. And that's about it. So if you need any further information, I guess, on either chown or chmod, it would just be obviously man chmod or man chown. If you need to know what group you're in, you can just type in groups, space, and then your username. So groups, clat2 would return, in this case, clat2 colon, that's my username, and then clat2 comma cranks, because I'm in clat2 and cranks. On my Slackware system, groups, clat2 returns. Clat2 colon users audio video and so on. So that's how to find out what you're in, and that's about it, I think. So hopefully that helps, and have a good time. topics in technical stuff or in Linux that are just so broad that it's almost hard to, number one, structure how to talk about it, and then number two, actually cover all the different, I guess, possible scenarios that someone might encounter. For that reason, I'm going to just kind of give a pastiche of different scenarios and the ways that you might be able to deal with them to get it to work. And I'm talking about drivers here. Now, I don't know how much experience you've got with drivers. I know that in the past, before Linux, I had, I would say, maybe on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being just a whole lot of experience, I'd say I had about a 1. Because Mac OS, everything, obviously, was always tailored specifically for their hardware. So you never had to worry about drivers, unless you did something crazy, like buy something non-Apple and plug it into your Apple computer. Nothing like vendor lock-in, right? But on the off chance that you do go out and, say, get a Logitech mouse, you know, something, or a Microsoft mouse, or something like that, you might have to install a driver. And that was about my only experience, would be when I bought something that was not designed and manufactured and programmed by Apple, sometimes you'd have to install a driver. Although, honestly, I never was really one on getting the latest and greatest tech gear, so even when I did that, by the time I got that device, a lot of times the Apple programmers had caught up and had included the drivers into your base install anyway. So if you'd installed OS X at all without customizing it and trimming off all the extra drivers, a lot of times you would find that you already had the driver. So it was really quite frequently not necessary, and that was just kind of what I was used to. From the very first moment that I tried Linux, my percentage went up to probably more like 7. 1 to 7 in like one day. It was because I was trying Slackware on a computer. It was Slackware 11, my first Linux distribution and experience at all. Well, real experience. I'd tried a live CD, I think, previously. But couldn't get the Wi-Fi card to work, so I had to go and I had to figure out why not, and had to figure out how to get it working. And I tried to recompile the kernel, forgetting, not realizing that I needed the source code in order to compile that code into the kernel, so that didn't work for me, but I did get a nice kernel compiling lesson out of it, and then I finally realized that I could download the code and compile it and install it, and that actually worked for me, so that was kind of nice. And that is, of course, a great argument for two things. One, three things. One, using Slackware first and foremost. If you're new to Linux, get a Slackware box. Whether it's a partition, I mean, I had my, back in the day, I had my computer partitioned like three different ways, literally. One was a Slackware, this one computer, one was a Slackware, one was, I think, Ubuntu, and one was the distro hopping partition, while I tried to kind of find my place among distributions. So get Slackware on a machine somewhere, somehow. Just do it, because you're going to learn from it. And do it quickly, because it's slowly but surely getting easier and easier to get Slackware installed and up and running. So, you know, if you want to learn, you better get on it before it just becomes a one-click install. So that's one argument. The other argument, of course, is open source drivers and code and everything like that. You know, I mean, I think it's probably too much to hope for free software through the entire driver chain. I think you're going to find binary blobs here and there right now, you know, until some major changes occur, which hopefully will occur. But at least right now, I mean, the open source drivers, like what Intel is doing for a lot of their different products, like their Wi-Fi cards, their Intel graphic, I guess you could call them graphic chips, I don't know, they're sort of like, well, they get graphics on your screen, so they work. Don't work well, but they work. But the point is that you've got the drivers there that you can then install pretty much no matter what. And that's important, I think, because how many times have I, as a PowerPC Linux user, I come across some kind of thing that I simply can't get working on with PowerPC because there are no open source drivers. It's not going to happen. They might have Linux drivers, but not many companies think, when they think, okay, let's do Linux drivers, they're not thinking, let's do Linux PowerPC drivers. they're thinking, let's do Linux drivers. And they do the sort of Intel chip driver that they know that most people are using, and so they're covering most of the user base. But they're not covering them all, and the PowerPC users among us lose out on that because it's not open source or free driver code. It is simply code that's been compiled for Linux, at least for a subset, or a, not a subset, but the majority of Linux users. But that doesn't, that's not everybody. So big argument, I guess, for open source and free drivers. I think that's an important thing. And you don't maybe realize it if you're just one of the people using the default setup, you know, the Intel or AMD or whatever Linux box. You might not notice, is it free? Is it open source? Do I have access to this code? Can I take it and compile it for my platform? Feels like you can because you're running Linux and it works, but think of the people not using your exact computer. You know, think of the people using PowerPC or whatever other architectures are out there. So that's just something to think about, and I think it's important to think about that. But anyway, it really is an aside. So I think that was a segment in itself. So now let's start talking about drivers. We're not going to talk about drivers yet. First, I have to rant about printers, but this is going to be a really quick one. I hate printers. I really hate printers. I never have liked printers. I always thought they were either never high enough quality or just they had the quality, but they didn't have the reliability. So I do not like printers. If I could do away with all things that need to be printed, I would. I want to do everything by email or, you know, just throw it onto a USB stick or something and give the file to someone, have them load it onto their computer and be done with it. I do not want to have to ever take paper to anyone. But we're not there yet. Not everyone will accept forms via email and such, so that's not the case. So very recently, since I'm doing a couple of different things, I've got a job application out there for a teaching gig. I've got a school application in so I can go learn how to be the elite hacksaw programmer type of person. So between those two things, I actually do need a printer. So I went out and bought a Canon printer and forgot to check if it was supported by Linux before I bought it. Huge mistake, of course. I don't know what made me think of, you know, why I didn't check on that first. But luckily, I got back with the printer, or rather, the printer came to the house. It was on the, I bought it from like buy.com, I think, or Newegg or something. And of course, the printer was very cheap, and it was Canon. Turns out they do support Linux, and I got the drivers installed and everything. But the real issue I have with printers, aside from how expensive their ink is and what a ripoff it always is, and how either their quality is no good or their reliability is horrible, and you know, you print one manuscript of like 200 or 300 pages, and suddenly your printer's shaking itself to pieces. I mean, like, it just falls apart right before it prints that one last page. Whatever. The other thing that I hate about it is the very idea that you need special manufacturer-specific drivers. I mean, computers and printers have been around long enough at this point for there to have been a truly common and universal method of getting the signal out to the printer and making it print a page. And I know what you're thinking. Well, Klaatu, there's cups. Haven't you ever heard of cups? Of course I've heard of cups. I love cups. The issue is that that doesn't always work, and Fumatic doesn't always work, and Gutenprint doesn't always work. So there are certain things that are obviously common enough across the board that will get your signal out to the printer. And believe me, I'm one of the people who I do not need a fancy, I don't need all the fancy functions on a printer. My problem is that most printers you get, you plug them in, and they might be detected as something that's plugged into a USB port, but there's no way to communicate with that device. You should be able to plug a printer in, use a line printer daemon to talk to that printer and print out a page of text without concern over any driver. That's just how it ought to be. If you need the extra fancy features like full duplex printing or, you know, borderless printing, borderless image printing, stuff like that, fine. I guess I'll accept that might need some manufacturer-specific code. Although, honestly, I wonder about that, and I wonder that if the manufacturers, if someone came up with some kind of standard and the manufacturers decided to play along, which, you know, you and I know that they probably wouldn't, but if someone did and if the manufacturers did play along, I'm pretty sure probably that the mechanics of a printer just don't vary that wildly so that they can do all these things with some kind of common universal driver code or specification. And that was just an obligatory printer rant, and now we're going to talk about printers. I mean drivers and printers. Time for a cup of coffee. So why don't you go get yourself a cup of coffee, and I'll go get myself a cup of coffee, and we'll come back and enjoy it together as we continue the show. So, got my cup of coffee, and before we jump into the whole issue of drivers, I have to say that making your own blends of coffee sometimes is a wonderfully satisfying experience. And it's a tricky thing because if you just take, you know, all the last couple of tablespoons out of all the different coffees that you have on the shelf or in the freezer or wherever you keep it and slap it all together hoping that you have enough for a full cup, you know, well, okay, maybe that's not going to work. But if you think about it and really choose which coffee you want to mix with another coffee and then think about the proportions, you can come up with some really good mixes. I have a simple little 4-cup coffee maker, and it usually turns out that about 5 tablespoons of ground coffee to, you know, to the full pot of water is about the strength that I like. So I'll frequently do blends of 3 to 2, so 3 tablespoons of one kind of coffee and then 2 of another, using the simple idea that the 3 tablespoon coffee is going to be the dominant flavor and the 2 is going to be the more subtle flavor, and it usually works out about that way. And yeah, I've been having a lot of fun with that. I don't know if you've ever tasted pure Kona coffee from Hawaii, but it's not all that good, like as just 100% nothing but Kona beans. Not my favorite way of drinking Kona. So what I'll do is I'll take the pure Kona and then I'll cut it with some other flavor, or not flavor, but some other kind of coffee. I don't know what you call it, genus of coffee, you know, whatever. But yeah, do that and you a lot of times get a better cup of coffee, at least in my humble opinion. And it's obviously completely up to you. It's just your own personal taste. But that's the way I've been doing it, and I've been happy with it. So happy with it, obviously, that I had to talk about it on a podcast. So obviously I'm pretty happy with it. Or maybe I'm just really happy to have a cup of coffee right now, and I'm just overwhelmed and going on and on about it. So what we'll do is get onto the more Linuxy stuff now. Now we really will tackle drivers, and this is a huge topic with no easy answer. It's not something that you can simply go into IRC and say, how do I install drivers on Linux and get an answer, because it's not a recipe. It's not kind of a 1-2-3 kind of deal. And honestly, I don't know if it is a recipe answer on any system. It just really kind of depends, because you never really know where the drivers are going to come from in any particular case. Luckily, there's a certain feel, a certain workflow to all of it, that if you get the hang of that, it will greatly improve your ability to get drivers installed and functioning with your Linux computer, or again, any computer really. There's just kind of a certain flow to it, kind of like, you know, when you're troubleshooting something, there's kind of that sort of order of things that you're going to do in order to see where the breakage is. In this case, there's an order of things that you want to do to make it work. So the 3 basic steps, looking at a very top-level view, the 3 most basic steps are search your computer, search your repository, search the internet. It's kind of, for me at least, it is in that particular order. Certainly searching your computer is first. If you want to jump out to the internet first, you can. I find that it usually wastes a lot of my time. So here's what I would, here's the more specific steps. The first thing to do is search your computer with either LSUSB or LSPCI. These are brilliant programs that will tell you all kinds of information about a device. Most importantly, what the device is. You know, I mean, like if you're looking for a Wi-Fi driver, You might not have physical access to that card without breaking open your computer, which you may or may not want to do. And even then, the brand on the top of the card might, you know, on the sticker, might not be the brand of the chip on the inside. So this is where LFPCI comes in really handy. After you've done that, you'll have basically determined what driver you are looking for, or at least what device it is that you are looking to install a driver for. I search my repositories immediately after I figure out what the device is, because there's a chance that someone else using your distribution has come across this need for a driver already, and may have already gone to the trouble of packaging that driver and putting it in a repository, so that all you'll have to do is do a quick install driver, and suddenly you're finished, and now you're done, and you're up and running, and you're using your device. No need to ever go out onto the big world wide web. Now, if it's not in your repository, you do have to go out to the www, and you have to do a couple of searches for this device, driver, Linux, or whatever. How do I get Canon IP2600 working on Linux? See what the forums are saying, see what the manufacturer's site says, and so on. Eventually, hopefully, you'll find the driver and you can download it and install it in whatever way the manufacturer or the provider of that driver has made it so that you can install it. Sometimes it's easier than other times. But generally speaking, that's the workflow. That's the idea of finding drivers for Linux, and I guess in a way it's pretty similar to how you would do it on any system, although on some systems it has a lot of those steps kind of backwards, you know, and it will search, some automatic, you know, driver helper will pop up and try to guess what driver you need, and it will do all these searches and lead you on completely thinking that it's going to automatically resolve all of this for you. And then, of course, it fails at the end, and you're back to square one, searching through your computer to see if you've actually got the driver installed and just not activated, or what the device is exactly, and then doing a manual search for that driver. So taking a couple of examples just so that we can do some practice runs here. Intel 3945 Wi-Fi card at one point was not built into the kernel, and when you would install something, you would have to actually get a driver for the Intel 3945. Now, very, very user-friendly distributions will kind of do essentially an LSUSB or an LSPCI without you being aware of it, you know, probing the hardware, seeing what you need. It will search the repository for you to see if that driver is available, and then either install it for you or ask you if you want to install it. It just kind of depends on the way the distribution is doing things. And this is pretty cool and really nice, except that now when you come up against something that the user-friendly distro doesn't recognize, you get to do it yourself, and you don't really know the process. So now you do know the process. So the first thing you do, let's say that you've got an Intel, if you've got a wireless card, and it's not working. It's never worked. You just now installed the distribution, and nothing is happening with your wireless card. So the first step is, of course, do an LSPCI, because the wireless card is going to be on the PCI bus. Now, it will list all the things that you've got in PCI slots, and you'll see your wireless card listed there eventually, and you'll see all the details about it. So in this case, let's say it's an Intel 3945 card. This means that now you know the manufacturer, you know what the device is called, so now you know what to go search for. So you might do like a repository search for, I don't know, Intel or Intel 3945, and you would probably, well, in this day and age, you would probably see a driver available for it, and you could do a quick install, how, you know, whatever package manager you're using, install that driver, and that might be really all you need to do. Let's assume that it's not available in your repository. So failing that, your next step would be to search the internet, and you can turn to any source that you feel is most reliable. You might go to Intel's site first and navigate through their, I'm sure, their maze-like site, and try to figure out if they have drivers available for Linux for that card. And in this case, actually, you would find out that yes, they do. They have open source drivers with some binary blobs, I believe, for their wireless card, and it is available for Linux. I don't know if they actually have like RPM and deb files available for it or not, but I know that they have the tar.gz file, so you can download that read the readmes, just like we did in episode 409 or 410 or whatever, whenever we were talking about compiling. Untar the package and read the readme files, because they will tell you how to compile the code and then what to do after it's all compiled. And this is all very important, and this is just going through and kind of doing the due process, you know, of actually reading the file so that you know what the process is. That takes a lot of the mystery out of everything. So the readme file would tell you to do the .slash configure make and the sudo make install or su-c quote make install end quote, and then to do a mod probe Intel 3945. Now, if you hadn't read the readme file, you wouldn't know to do that. It would also tell you to copy some of the little binary blobs to certain directories in your file system. So again, you wouldn't know to do that either. So if you just went with it and just kind of poked your way through it and just tried to install it on your own, you wouldn't do it right. It wouldn't work. So the readme file is important. So you'd read that, you'd figure out where to copy all your little binary blobs to, and what needs to be compiled, and how it needs to be compiled, and you would do that, and then it would say to do mod probe Intel 3945, and you'd do that, and now you've got a working wireless card, and it should pop up in either your network manager, or WICD, or an ifconfig, or whatever. Now, a similar example would be a Broadcom card. Back in the day, it was fairly difficult to get a Broadcom card working under Linux, because it just took a lot of steps and a lot of weird steps, like firmware cutting and things like that. As of, I guess, a couple of months ago now, it's a lot easier, and you simply, again, if my wireless card isn't working, I'll do an LSPCI, find out what make and model it is, what chipset it is. I would look through my repository to see if they've got anything for me. Now they do, and I would download the B43 firmware cutter or the BCMXXXX firmware cutter and run those, and it will do most of the work for me. And then I would do, I think I might have to do a mod probe myself. I don't remember. I think it actually might do it for me as well. But after that, I'd be up and running. So these days, a repository search would suit you, would solve your issues quite quickly. And honestly, that's about it. That's what's involved with driver installation. Now, let's say, like I said, I got a printer recently because I needed one, and brought it home, plugged it in, didn't work. First stop was LSUSB, right? Okay, so I do an LSUSB, I see that the printer is, yes, it's plugged in, it's on, and the computer is aware that it's plugged in. So something's happening from the printer to the computer. Now I need to get the computer talking to the printer the other way. So first thing I did was go to Canon's site and look around for the drivers, navigate through their driver, and I think it's drivers and downloads submenu, and you go through and you kind of click around, and you finally see that, sure enough, for the IP2600 Pixma Canon printer, there are drivers for Windows from like 98 all the way up to Vista, including ME. I mean, it's got every Windows driver you could ever want. It's got a couple of different ones for OS 10, like 10.3, 10.4, and 10.5. And sure enough, there's no Linux driver. Not good. So now I go out to the internet search engines, and I just do a generic kind of like, how do I get my Canon IP2600 working with Linux? Eventually, I find a link to an Asian support site that Can has. And bizarrely enough, while they're English support sites didn't have Linux drivers posted for that model, their Asian support site does. And so I just downloaded the tar.gz for my Slackware system and the .rpms for my Fedora system. Now, in this case, there's not like a mod probe that we need to do, but we do have to get something in the user space kind of aware of that printer's existence. And in this case, I just did the whole cups thing. So I did local open to conquer localhost colon 631, pointed the, when it asks about what driver it wants to use, I pointed it to the ijfilter-2.90 something or another, and did a test page print, and it worked like a charm. So that was quite satisfying. Now, before I even did all that, I did try to use generic printer drivers with the 2600. Both Fumatic and Gutenprint. I gave it the old college try. It didn't work. So I did need the Canon, official Canon drivers. So, but with printers, I typically do try just the generic ones first and foremost. Try to set it up in cups, you know, just using whatever generic driver I can find that seems to be closest to that printer model. In this case, just nothing worked, and it really did need both the, I think it's an IJFilter-Common and IJFilter-IP2600 file from the Canon, like I said, Asia support site. So the configuration of the system to use the driver is an important step that you can't really overlook. It is an important step, and generally speaking, frequently it is something that is required. This would be kind of the if config step in the wireless examples. You know, after you install the drivers for a wireless card, and after you make sure that the drivers are active in the kernel with like a mod probe or something like that, then you need to make sure that the real user kind of level applications are aware that device exists and that you want to actually use it. So for a wireless card, it would be ifconfig and iwconfig, you know, to kind of set it up. For a printer, it would be cups. For webcams, for instance, it would be something entirely different, and sometimes it's something very, very obscure. So this final example is probably one of the weirder examples, but it's just kind of good to throw out there so that you're aware of such situations. And yet again, the whole power of the internet is witnessed, because this is one of those things that you're just not going to think of unless you see it on the internet telling you, here's what you need to do. So I installed Slackware 12.2 on my EEE PC a few weeks ago now, updated it to current. So it's got a fairly current kernel, default Slackware kernel. It's got some drivers and stuff like that, some updated things. It's really nice, by the way, for the EEE. Dan Washko was right all along. Slackware is the way to go for the EEE PC. It works so well, really, really nicely. I mean, it does Kwin effects and everything. It's cool. That notwithstanding, the webcam did not work out of the box. This kind of surprised me, because I'd read on the internet that the driver that the EEE PC camera needed was installed in the was included in the Linux kernel. So I didn't really understand why it wouldn't be working. So the first thing I did was I searched the system for the driver that I'd read that webcam uses, which was the UVC video driver. Turns out that, yeah, UVC driver was in the system. It was installed. It was already in that kernel and everything. So, I mean, I had the driver. So then I did an SU-C quote, mod probe UVC video end quote, and, you know, thereby inserting the driver into the kernel, making sure it was running and everything. And sure enough, if I did an ls mod grep UVC video, the driver was there. UVC video was running, video dev was using UVC video, and v4l compat was using UVC video and video dev. So all the normal, typical things that I would do for driver installation have been done at this point, and yet the thing is still not working. So I installed a couple of different webcam apps. Well, I mean, Cheese and Webcam, W-E-B-K-A-M, the latter of which is pretty experimental right now, so probably not recommended. But I tried both of those. I tried Copete and went into the portion of it that uses, you know, webcam, and tried to get that thing running, and it just wasn't there. I mean, the webcam just wasn't really being recognized by the system as something that existed. Very unusual. Luckily, an internet search revealed that what I had to do was activate the webcam itself, and the command for that was just echo the number one, echo one, and redirect that echo to /sys/devices/platform/eeepc/camera. So it turns out that there's this little file that represents the camera in the sys directory that at first is set to zero, meaning no, there's no camera. And so you set that to one, and then it means actually yes, there's a camera. I don't remember if I had to reboot or what, but after that, the webcam worked as expected. So I hope some of that helped. It can seem a little bit confusing sometimes, because it's not one of those recipe answers that has three easy steps and then you're done. It is something a lot more involved. It's something that you have to kind of roll with it and kind of do what each different device needs you to do. But I think that the three broad strokes are still applicable, and that is that you search your system to know what you're dealing with, you search your repository to make sure that someone hasn't already done all your work for you, and then you search the internet for either any additional tips or you know, any additional magical config files or things that you need to echo or whatever. Or links to the actual driver on some foreign site, whatever. So those are the steps that I have in my mind when I go to install drivers for Linux. And to be honest, it's even what I have in mind if someone comes to me with any other computer system. On Mac, they don't have LSUSB and LSPCI, but they do have IO Reg, /W0. So you can kind of do some investigation that way. And on Windows, I have no idea how to do any of that stuff. So the one time so far someone's come to me with a Windows computer with problems installing drivers, which was actually quite recently. Someone was trying to install XP after she'd wiped Vista off the hard drive in complete and utter disgust. She brought me an XP computer, not understanding that someone knowing a lot about Mac and Linux doesn't necessarily know anything about Windows. But, you know, I had no idea what to do with it, so I popped in a Fedora Live CD, and I'm happy to report that almost everything worked out of the box on the Fedora Live CD. And meanwhile, her XP install had the wrong resolution, no sound, no Ethernet, no wireless. It was one step away from being a paperweight for her. But yeah, popped in Fedora CD and everything worked, everything but the wireless card. And that could have been made to work with the B43 FW Cutter install from the Yum repository. So that could have been working within no time. I got an email from Tim about the command line episode that I did for X10, I think, or 09 or something. But, yeah, he says I forgot, quote-unquote, forgot to include MC. MC is, I think that's the official name, because it's based on something called Midnight Commander. And I could be wrong about that, I haven't looked it up, but I know that Midnight Commander, I guess, was a sort of, I guess you'd call it a legacy or historical file manager. Two pane setup, one pane on the left, one on the right, and you can kind of configure it such that, or I guess people typically use it such that on the left, you know, might be your source and the right might be your destination or whatever. So you kind of manage your files that way. And that's quite nice, and it's good for a lot of people, and it's in curses based, so you can run it from just a straight up text console. As long as you've got incurses installed, you know, you're good to go. I've used MC a little bit, and most of my experience has been when I was doing a lot of OS X stuff. I was really, really building up a Unix environment for myself. If you've heard the first episode of Season 2, you'll know. I mean, this is, or it's the last episode of Season 1, actually, which was the first episode of The Bad Apples. You'll know I basically stripped down OS X until essentially there was nothing left to the Cocoa layer, practically, and I just built up the X environment that way. And in terms of getting a file manager to compile on top of the Darwin kernel, and with this whole BSD subsystem, didn't have much luck at first. I think eventually I got, or rather someone else got, because they ported Rocks Filer and possibly Thunar. I think I only had Rocks Filer. But until someone else ported that, it was just me and MC in terms of a graphical file manager. And I did want a graphical, something of a graphical file manager, just so that I could open the computer and show people and have at least something to show when they wanted to see that I actually had files on the computer, you know, that I actually used it, which is hard to do when you don't have a file manager. It's just kind of hard to show someone something that's, I mean, the text terminal is cool to us, but to a lot of people it's completely meaningless. And at least something with an incurses interface, at least they can see, okay, I've got menus, I can use my arrow keys to scroll through this list, etc. So it was nice. It was useful for what it was being done. Another great use for it, I mean, a much more practical use. Well, no, actually, that's one practical use, and the use there would be if you can't get, you know, if you're having a hard time getting something compiled, or, you know, if you're just stuck in an environment, is what I'm trying to say, where you don't have the luxury of a lot of different file managers. I mean, maybe you don't have an X session at all, in which case your two choices are the terminal and Midnight Commander. And as Tim or MC rather. And as Tim points out, I mean, if you're not super duper Unix savvy, then MC is a really kind of a lifesaver, because you just don't have to learn any of those commands. You've got a little GUI of sorts to figure out, and if you're the type of person who can kind of sift their way through a GUI until they understand it, this might be the perfect tool for you. So MC is definitely a nice little tool. Great to have that around. Do I use it personally? Not really anymore. I mean, even when I had it, I didn't use it that much. I really do favor just the terminal and the Unix commands. I don't think there's a whole lot that MC can do that, you know, a good LS pipe grep can't do. So, you know, there's that. But a lot of people aren't going to use those Unix commands, and so MC is a big help for them. It's also just really helpful if you need the graphic file manager and don't have a graphical environment. I mean, that's what incursus is all about, right? So it's really cool. So check it out, MC. That's usually how it's listed in repositories. So just yum install MC or aptitude install MC or whatever you choose, URPMI MC, whatever. But yeah, thanks Tim for reminding me about good old MC. Well, I do believe that's about all I've got for this episode, folks. So I'm going to wrap it up. This has been Bad Apples. My name is Klaatu. Need to reach me? You can reach me at Klaatu at Hacker Public Radio. Reach me at Klaatu at linuxcranks.info. The Bad Apple website is thebadapples.info. There's not a whole lot on there right now, but show notes, things like that is there. Blog feeds and index pages for the old seasons. So check that out if you need it. And other than that, just have fun on Linux, and I'll see you next week.
Being funny now.
I'm not being funny at all. If you'd like to talk to my doctor, you may.